Matthew chapter 8, verses 5 to 13, and Luke chapter 7, verses 2 to 10. Now, careful study of these two Gospels accounts yields interesting information about the unnamed centurion and gives us several challenges. And this is what I want you to look at here tonight. Number one, what can we know about this man? All right, so as you look at passages like this, go ahead and read it. The beginning with verse number 5, and we'll read down to verse number 13. And Jesus entered, and when Jesus entered into Capernaum, right, where was Capernaum? Where was it located?
The coast.
All right, it was the top end of Galilee.
It was on the border?
Yeah, it was right on the coast of Galilee at the very top north side. Okay, so he entered into Capernaum. Remember, Capernaum was his adopted home. He grew up in Nazareth, but he moved his family to Capernaum. There came unto him a centurion beseeching him and saying, Lord, my servant lieth at home sick of the palsy, grievously tormented. Jesus saith unto him, I will come and heal him. And the centurion answered and said, Lord, I'm not worthy that thou shouldest come under my roof, but speak the word only, and my servant shall be healed. And for I am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say unto this man, go, and he goeth, and to another, come, and he cometh, and to to my servant, do this, and he doeth it. When Jesus heard this, he marveled, and said to them that followed, verily I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. And I say unto you that this that many shall come from the east and west, and shall sit down with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the children of the kingdom shall be cast into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And Jesus said unto the centurion, go thy way, as thou hast believed, so be it done unto thee. And his servant was healed the selfsame hour. All right, now I'm not going to be dealing with verse 12, but let me comment on verse 12 so I don't just overlook it. But the children of the kingdom shall be cast into outer darkness. So what he's talking about there, he's saying, he was addressing the Jews. He's saying, this man who's not a Jew has great faith, and there's going to be many that sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom. But the children of the kingdom, the ones that were supposed to be in there, the Jewish people that were supposed to enter into the kingdom, they won't believe, and they're going to be cast into outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. So when he talks about the children of the kingdom, he's not talking about those that are already in there going to get cast out. He's saying these are the ones that he intended to be in there, his own people, the Jewish people, and they're going to miss out. But this man here was not a Jew, and he was a man of great faith. So he kind of sandwiches that in there and just kind of drives home a point there. But that's not part of our lesson tonight, but I want to make sure I identified that so that you understood that. So as we look at this, we'll eventually read most of Luke as well. But what do we see about this man? Well, first of all, as you read there, we find out that he was a centurion. Okay? Now, the centurions were captains over 100 soldiers, and commentators make various comments that can help us. Barnes, in his commentary, said, a centurion was a commander of 100 men in the Roman armies. Judea was a Roman province, and garrisons were kept there to preserve the people in subjection. This man was probably by birth a pagan. Right, David Guzik adds here, he says, most every Jew under Roman occupation felt a reason to hate this centurion. Yet he comes to the Jewish teacher, and not for a selfish reason, but on the behalf of his servant. And then Pope of Commentary adds this. Says it should be observed, by the way, that even the imperial troops stationed in Palestine were drawn not from distant lands, but from the non-Jewish inhabitants of the country, perhaps especially the Samaritans. All right, so put all that stuff together, and here's a man of great power. He's a military leader. He's got 100 soldiers under him, and he's working for the emperor and directly under Herod the king. And he comes to Jesus for help. All right, so this man, most people didn't like the centurions, obviously, because they were the Romans ruling over them, and they didn't like the Romans ruling over them. So they were, you know, hated by them in many respects. But this man was respected because of his, because he was a different kind of a leader, obviously. And we see, too, because of his position, he was a powerful and responsible leader. I mean, no man could earn such rank unless he was a true leader. Okay? And, you know, you look at that even in our own society. Occasionally people will push their way to the top of some position without deserving to be there, and usually they make a big mess of it because they don't deserve to be there. But people who are genuinely leaders will work themselves into positions of leadership because of their qualities. And so this man was obviously a man who had been chosen by the perhaps the emperor or someone under the emperor to be a commander over 100 soldiers, a big responsibility there in the Roman army. And his position gave him great power and great authority. So here's a man of note and power and authority there in Israel. And being that the case, he also had a kind heart. He was generous and pious. Right now we see more of this mentioned, or we can see a little bit of it here, but Luke delves into this a little bit more. All right, so it just mentions he's a man that was compassionate toward his sick servant. But look over in Luke, and in Luke chapter 7, and we'll begin, well, I'll just start, begin with verse 2 so we catch the whole context. And a certain centurion's servant, who was dear unto him, was sick and ready to die. All right, so he's added a little bit more information there. He says he's not only was he severely sick, but he was ready to die. And verse 3, when he heard of Jesus, he sent unto him the elders of the Jews, beseeching him that he would come and heal his servant. And now Luke presents it from a different angle. Luke presents it in the sense that the centurion didn't actually come in person, but being a high-ranking officer, he had lots of people working under him, and so he went and in the first context here, he contacted the Jewish leaders and said, go talk to this Jesus and tell him that I want him to come heal my servant. Right. Verse number 4. And when he came to Jesus, they besought him instantly and saying that he was worthy for whom he should do this. All right, so here's these Jewish leaders that are telling Jesus, please help this fella because he's a worthy guy. I mean, that's not the common thing to say about a Roman soldier. So they obviously held him in great respect because of his position and because of his character. For he loveth our nation and hath built us a synagogue. Now, that's pretty amazing. So this guy, Roman soldier, captain of these 100 soldiers, and yet he loved the nation of Israel so much that he used evidently his own money or his own influence in some way to build a synagogue. Now, what was a synagogue?
Temple, Jewish worship.
I don't know if it was a temple or not, but it was a place of Jewish worship.
Yeah, like
it was like a, you could compare it to a local church, right? It wasn't a local church, but you could compare it to that. So it was the place where the Jews would meet together. So they were often, most of the little towns had a synagogue. Right. And so he built them a synagogue. So this is pretty amazing. This guy, he had some sort of a generous, pious spirit about him that was unusual. Even though he was powerful and authoritative, also we see here in, let me see if he did it here in, okay, Matthew identifies something here that I don't see in Luke. All right, back in Matthew chapter, verse number 6, saying, Lord, my servant lieth at home sick with a palsy. He addressed Jesus as Lord. And now here's this man who's a high-ranking officer. He was important in the government. He was a powerful soldier. And he addresses Jesus as Lord. And we hear a man of Roman birth, powerful position, yet he's got a tender heart toward the Jews. And he seems to have a pious spirit. He seems to have some faith. You know, was he a proselyte Jew? You know, what's a proselyte?
Kind of gets... I guess he assimilates into the religion, even though he wasn't born Jewish.
He's adopted the Jewish religion. That's a possibility. There were a lot of people that did that. It doesn't say that that's what he did. But the way he's acting, you'd really wonder. But he's very kind toward the Jewish people. So then we see also, I alluded to it just briefly, but he was also very compassionate. He cared for his suffering servant. Now, something is very interesting. And I don't know why, but we find here in Matthew that Matthew uses a word that is different than the word used by Luke. He says here in verse number 8, verse number 6, saying, "Lord, my servant lieth at home sick." The word servant there is the Greek word, the Greek word pious, and it means a child or a servant. It refers to a child, someone young. So it doesn't refer to, it can refer to a servant, but it primarily refers to a child. And I think it's used about 14 times in the Bible, if I remember correctly, and about half of them are translated as children or child or maiden or a boy, and the other half were translated as servant. So it refers to both. But over in Luke, the word Luke uses is doulos, slave. So here we've got just the opposite here. He refers to the doulos. Now, if Luke hadn't said that, we wouldn't know. In fact, some people have translated this verse as his son. And it could refer to that. However, in the context, when Luke tells us it was his servant, we can be sure that it was a servant. All right, but it could very well have been a young servant. Someone who wasn't very old. It could have been a young servant. Right, and so those are some interesting things.
Could have been a servant that was like a son to him.
That could be too. Yeah, and he called him that more of an endeared title instead of just something, you know, just a slave.
Sometimes servants, if they were liked by a person, would have even more position than their own children. Mm. It wasn't uncommon. I mean, like.
So here's a man who truly loved his servant. And he was burdened about this, that his servant was sick. And he had palsy. And what was palsy?
Polio?
Fever that affects your brain?
Polio?
Nope.
Oh, the deformity?
Palsy is another word for paralyzed.
Oh.
Okay, so it may have had some of those other complications too. He says he was grievously tormented. Usually people that are paralyzed aren't tormented by it, but maybe mentally tormented, not so much physically tormented by it. But anyway, so this fellow's servant is laid up, he's laying in bed, he's grievously tormented, and he's burdened by all this.
Well, without modern bedding and ointments and stuff, which many of them didn't have, if you were bedridden, you would be extraordinarily tormented because your skin would be falling off and you'd be getting bed sores and you'd have fleas. And
thanks.
I mean, that's what happened. No, but that is what happened. That happens to people today if they go a few days without being moved. And,
yeah, with their bed sores, there's no question they get a lot
of
bed sores.
So, yeah, you can absolutely be tormented.
You're right, he could be. I didn't think of that aspect of it. That's a good point. All right. But then we see here in verse 8 that the centurion answered and said, "Lord, I am not worthy that thou shouldest come under my roof." Now think about that. Here is a high-ranking Roman official. The Romans looked at the Jews as their slaves. They had conquered. They were under their authority. And here's a man who's referring to Jesus as Lord, and he says, "I am not worthy that you should come under my roof." So here's a man who was very humble. He was, lowered himself And as Luke, we already read those verses, that Luke actually says that he's sent the Jewish leaders there to request of Jesus to come. And then when he got near Jesus' home, then he sent some friends out to talk to Jesus. Matthew just kind of lumps it all together and says that Jesus was talking to him. Now, sometimes you might look at that and we think, well, is there a contradiction there? Well, not necessarily, because if Luke was saying that he sent some people out there on his behalf, you know, those people were actually representing him officially. So there is a sense in which he was talking to him, but not necessarily to him in person because of the representation there.
Yeah, well, it's more of an overview in this passage compared to the other one. It's just kind of giving you the main information you need to know. It's not collaborating on the details. It's kind of like saying, like, I've been talking to this person, but you don't have to collaborate, whether it's, if you don't have time, you're not going to collaborate, whether it's email, or text, or in person.
Well, you know, another thing, too, is that as you think of the Gospels, the reason we have four Gospels is because they present the life of Christ in four, from four different perspectives. Matthew was writing primarily to who?
Jews.
Right? And that's why all through Matthew, he highlights things that were significant to the Jews. Even like this one section where he talks about, you know, there's going to be many that, you know, that are of the kingdom that are going to be cast out. Well, Luke doesn't mention that, because Luke's writing to the Romans. And they have Romans who don't care about that. But the Jews, that was a big thing to them. And so Matthew includes lots of little nuggets there that deal particularly with the Jews. And so each one, they highlight the ideas. When you get to John only gives us a little bit of Jesus' ministry. He kind of breaks it down into, I think, there are about seven different stories there, or little segments that he has there in John. And most of it deals with the crucifixion and resurrection in the book of John. A good portion of the book does. So John's dealing with a different aspect of it. The first three synoptic gospels, synoptic means they're similar. They were dealing with the life story of Jesus, but each one, Matthew to the Jews, and Mark presents him more of as a man. Luke presents to the Romans in a different perspective as well. So each one has their own way of looking at it. All right, now, as he came to Jesus, he said, I'm not worthy that you come to my house. But I want you to heal my servant. So he gives him an illustration. Amazing what he says here. Now, this is a man of great power. He said, verse 8, I'm not worthy that thou shouldest come under my roof, but speak the word only, and my servant shall be healed. For I am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say unto this man, go, and he goes. And to another, come, and he cometh. And to my servant, do this, and he doeth it. So what's he saying there? He's saying, I have authority, and I have people under me, and when I speak the word, they obey. And what he was saying to Jesus is, Jesus, I want you to just speak the word, and my servant will be healed. He says, I believe you have authority, you speak the word, and it's going to happen. Just like when I speak the word to my servant, I know he's going to obey.
If he was posted at a barracks with soldiers under him and he was like under watch, like, you know, like they're actively on duty, then he wouldn't have been able to go directly to Jesus anyway. That's why he sent servants. Jesus had to come close to him, because you can't just leave your post in active duty.
Well, he would have probably had time off, just like everybody else does too, but nonetheless.
He sent Jewish elders to
him. Yeah, the first time he sent Jewish elders, and then when he got closer to his house, Luke says that he sent friends.
Because it sounds like, to me, it seems like he had no choice. I mean, he obviously would go himself.
So he
sent friends, verse 6.
Yeah, so he sent friends to him, you know. So first of all, he calls him with the Jewish elders, and then
Jewish
when he came,
could have been his friends because he built the synagogue for him.
Could be.
And maybe that's why Jesus was willing to help him, whereas Jesus in another part, like the woman, the dog's crumbs under the table, so he wasn't willing to help her because she wasn't.
He was testing her. He knew what he was going to do. See, all of these stories, that's the cool thing. Is Jesus knew from the beginning what he was going to do. And I mean, in this situation, as soon as he saw this centurion, he knew what he was. He knew what was happening. He knew exactly what was going to take place. And he knew the man had faith. But he was showing these people the truth of this, and so he makes a big deal about how this man approaches him and how that he is asking to just speak the word, because I have authority, my servant obeys, my sons obey, everybody obeys me when I speak the word, so therefore you can speak the word and the healing will be taking place. And so he's emphasizing that to get that point across to them. So this is a really neat aspect of the story. Now, then in verse number 10, when Jesus heard it, he marveled. You know, that is amazing when you really think of it. The Lord Jesus marveled. He was saying, I'm amazed. This is amazing. Now, obviously, he was God. He knew it all before it all happened. But he was human in that sense as well. And he marveled. And he said unto them that followed, verily I say unto you, I have not found so great a faith, no, not in Israel. Now, if that would have been said by anybody else, it wouldn't have held nearly as much power. But it was said by the Lord. He said, I have not found so great a faith in all of Israel. This centurion had greater faith than his disciples, greater faith than his followers, greater faith than anybody else.
His mother, father.
Yeah, greater faith than all of them. He says, I've never seen this great a faith. So it was so great that he could just speak the word and say, do it, and you know, and most everybody wanted him to come and touch him or to you know, pray over them or do something. This man said, no, you don't even need to come close, just speak the word, and it'll be done. Amazing faith.
So he must have known something. I mean, you don't just go up to...
Well,
he would have heard bits and pieces.
Yeah, he probably heard Jesus preach. I mean, he's near there at Capernaum. Jesus had preached around Capernaum lots of times. And so he may have heard Jesus preach, you know, even when they were on duty, standing guard and stuff. He might have been standing out when Jesus was preaching to the crowds, and he's keeping an eye on to make sure there's no riots or anything. And
he might have been looking for the Messiah as much as, you know.
Especially if he was a Jewish convert in his heart. You know, he could have been. You're right. He may have been.
Yeah, but I think it's important, like you said earlier, the Romans Empire didn't have the one of their strategies that made them so powerful, just like the Persian Empire long before them, is that they didn't rely on just their own resources and manpower. That never worked. As they conquered an area, they would usually set a local ruler over the area. There would sometimes be a local or a Roman, and then he would have locals under him. So they knew that the strategy works better if you don't fully destroy, but you rather infiltrate and then work on top of that. So that's why they didn't just destroy the Jews and their religion. They rather just integrated with them. And so this guy could have been even if he was Jewish, it didn't necessarily stop him from getting a position from the Romans.
Well, that is a possibility. Yeah, it doesn't say, but the implication, well, the very implication of what Jesus said, he said, I haven't seen this in Israel.
Yeah.
So that implication is like, this man's not of Israel.
Yeah.
But I've not seen that kind of faith in Israel. So I think we can safely say he was not an Israelite, but he may have been a proselyte that had joined with them. That is a very great possibility. You know, and how then did, well, Jesus complimented him for this, and then how do we see that Jesus responded? Well, this was part of the response. Jesus was marveled, he complimented the man, but then in verse 11, 11 and 12, he goes on this thing with the Jewish people, and we've already commented on that a little bit. But then in verse 13, he said unto the centurion, go thy way, and as thou hast believed, so be it done unto thee. And the servant was healed the self same hour. Now over in Luke, when we see the same thing there in Luke, verse number 9, when Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him and turned him about and said unto the people that followed him, I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel.
What's it saying? Jesus marveled at him.
At the man.
What's the marvel meaning? To be amazed or astounded?
Yeah, he was amazed at him. He said, this is amazing. And verse 10, and they that were sent, returning to the house, found the servant whole that had been sick. So Jesus never went there, never saw the guy, unless maybe later. But he just spoke the word. and he healed him. And so it is truly amazing what he did there. Now, what should we learn from this? Every story in the Bible is there. Everything is there for our learning. You know, God honors those who humbly have faith in him. And those two things go hand in hand. You know, as I was thinking over this, God despises competition. That is one of the reasons why God makes such a big deal about humility, because he can't stand competition. And he alone is God, and he has no just rivals. You know, many times in our minds, if we're not careful, we can think, well, hang on, no, that's, you know, that's kind of cocky of him. No, it's not cocky of him to say that, because he is the sovereign. He is the king. He is God, and there's no rivals with him. Nobody comes close to him, and anybody that thinks they do is stepping out of line, because there is no one that even comes close. And so every time we get a bit, you know, cocky in ourselves and proud and puffed up and rebellious.
The only time in the Bible where God does give men power and fame of his own will when he does it is when that's not the main thing they're seeking. Like Solomon wasn't seeking fame and fortune.
Right.
And because his heart was there, then God didn't actually mind to give him fame and fortune, because he knew that's not what he wanted. So God doesn't actually have an issue with people being famous and fortune, but in some context, but he cares about why they want to be there.
Yeah.
And that's what
matters. Yeah, I mean, many times throughout the Bible and in Proverbs and various places, it talks about even that if we, that just today I was read a verse there that talked about that those who get wisdom, wisdom is the key, and I'm not remembering the exact verse, but it basically was saying that wisdom is the key to honor and riches.
Yeah, but humility comes.
And so there's, they work hand in hand. The humility there works hand in hand with this stuff. And so, yeah, so one of the great things here we can see is God is greatly pleased when his servants like you and me are humble and not rebellious and puffed up. And humility must precede faith. You know, in order to have faith in God, now faith is acting upon trusted information. And in order for us to have faith in God, acting upon the trusted information that he is able to do exactly as he said, we have to have humility to have that kind of faith, because it's humbly saying, I can't, he can, he's great, I'm not, and I can depend upon him, and I can trust him to do what I cannot do. And so faith is acting upon that trusted information. And we desperately need to cultivate these two qualities, humility and faith. And, you know, there are things that we struggle with. And, you know, I could speak more for myself than anybody else, but I know in my own heart that humility, it's a battle. Every time we think we're starting to get humble, we're probably not.
It's the reason this centurion was in such a high position is because, I mean, the reason I think people can sometimes get to a high position is because to be able to receive wisdom and learn things, you have to be able to not have an ego, in the sense of like arrogance will stop you. So a guy that is kind of like a strong man and doesn't even want to, well, you're just a peasant, what do I have to care what you say, or what do I have to care what you say? It's me and nobody else, right? He's never going to learn just from the little guy. Because a humble guy, he probably was just as open to hearing what his servants had to tell him as, you know, Caesar. And that's what made him so great. That's why he could connect. That's why he was popular with the people, because everybody knew this guy doesn't just hang out with the elite. He'll come down to our level and hear what we have to say. What can we do?
That's very true.
And that made him so famous and popular.
Okay. So some real things for us to focus on here, the humility and faith. And oh, how we need more faith. You know, God is able. This man just said, Lord, you don't even have to come close. You just speak the word. And he believed that it would happen, because he so trusted his servants. I mean, he obviously treated his servants well, but he knew his servants were going to be obedient to him. And he spoke the word. He said, I know they're going to obey me. No, not a question. I don't have to wonder. They will.
And I guess it also reminds you, you don't need physical access to Jesus. And you know, some people, like today, like they'll claim that they had some sort of manifestation where Jesus appeared to them and healed them something, but it doesn't. Jesus, you don't physically have, like, Jesus did go around in those days physically touching people and healing them, but he just did that as well to interact with them, because he has a personality. He's not a robot, but at the same time he's just equally capable of just thinking the thought and healing somebody. And my point is that just because Jesus is in heaven today, it makes it absolutely no difference whether he's physically here or he's there. It makes no difference.
You're right.
Equal access. There's no distance.
So anything else you can think of that we can glean from this passage?